Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 102, we'll be asking if there are any surprises in the findings of the 2011 Global Peace Index published this week.
This year, the top five rises are Georgia, Sri Lanka and Thailand, and also Chad and Mongolia. On the fallers, there's Libya, Bahrain and Egypt, and indeed North Korea, and also the island of Madagascar.
That was Clyde McConaughey from the Institute for Economics and Peace, and we'll be heading over to Stockholm to discover a booming bookstore business model.
When you sell a generic product as paperback books, obviously are, then it's about the way you sell them. We do focus a lot on training the staff so they can really help the consumer finding the right book.
That was Per Stradell from The Pocket Shop. And later in the program, we talked to Julia Tristram Eve from the English Wine Producers to hear what the highlights are from this week's English Wine Week.
A couple of weeks ago now, they announced the results in some of the international competitions, and we came out with some gold medals. And last year in the Decanter World Wine Awards, an English sparkling wine took the International Sparkling Wine Trophy, the first time a non-champagne producer has actually taken that award.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly.
Hello, it's Sunday, June 5th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London. I'm Tyler Brûlé, along with Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Andrew, what did you do with our Robert Bound this week?
Well, I think we might find out, but I think he's not done as well as he might have done in Venice.
Oh.
Which is to say that he actually, I understand, has been seeing a doctor while he's there. Oh. Not in a dating sense. He had to go and see a hospital. So find out more later on, I think.
Yes, well, he was out there making a film on the Venice Art Biennale, so hopefully he'll be able to gather around the microphone at some point. Mr. Bloomfield, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Did you go anywhere this week?
I went to the Algerian embassy.
How was that? Well, so you sort of went overseas. Did you cross over the threshold?
I did. So yes. Technically I was in Algerian territory,
right.
Which is, interesting.
And you're still able to use your Oyster card?
Just about, yes. Yeah. So no, we're talking to them.
Are you on your way to Algiers?
Not me, no. One of our correspondents
is
hopefully going to be winging his way to Algeria very soon, so long as, our new friends at the Algerian consulate smooth our path.
Very good. Guess where I was?
Where were you?
I went up to Sweden.
For a day?
No, I was in Sweden for 2 days. I went to open the summer house for the season, which was very nice. It was about 12 degrees. It was raining.
Which involves what? Taking shutters off windows? And
no shutters
leaves?
Off windows. You just need to make sure that that no large animals have crashed through any plate glass, etc. But there were a lot of trees that were destroyed. And someone said, yes, there was a lot of elk on the island because there were a lot of elk pellets everywhere.
Wow. Because they come swimming across?
Well, no, they're not swimming because wintertime they can just, it's all frozen in the archipelago in Stockholm, so they just march across. Because also with their antlers, you can see that when they crash through, it's not really a forest, but when they crash through the trees, they snap off all the branches at a certain height. So at about 7.5 feet, all small branches are just laying limp, which is quite funny.
That's quite amazing. The house has kind of secret life when you're not there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think very much so.
And 12 degrees, that's the
start wasn't great.
Of summer.
Yeah, it wasn't the start of summer. It wasn't fantastic. It did start to improve. And then I jumped down to beautiful Copenhagen. Copenhagen last Monday was absolutely stunning. And it's one of those moments when you just, you sit at a cafe, a great cafe called Granola, which I can highly recommend. And we went down this, I can't even remember the name of the street, but former red light district, which is starting to clean up. And it was like, any one of those streets that we would concoct in the magazine that had the two good wine stores. It had the Turkish greengrocer. It had then this wonderful coffee shop called Granola, a couple of nice, there's a wonderful cheese shop. And it was just this perfect little street and a great flower shop as well. So, and I just thought, yes, you could see yourself, retiring there and having a very nice life in Copenhagen.
But maybe not even retiring. You could get something even sooner, maybe.
Yeah, you could. Absolutely. But we're not going to talk about sort of complete lifestyle re-engineering. There's... you gentlemen have a lot of paper sitting around you. Aside from all the Sunday papers that you have around you, but also there is a big report in front of you which came out early in the week from the Institute for Economics and Peace, the GPI, the Global Peace Index. There's about 400 pages to it. Distill it for me, Steve Bloomfield, 50. In 5 seconds or less.
It's all about how the world's quite dangerous, but not maybe quite as dangerous as we thought.
Really?
How's that?
Yeah, and what are the big scary places? Any surprises for you?
One surprise was apparently Chad's slightly safer. I still wouldn't really want to go to Chad.
Right.
But, you know, apparently it's a bit safer than it used to be. And Somalia has reclaimed the top spot, or the bottom spot, depending on which way you want to see it, and is now less safe than Iraq.
I'm trying to get to
Iraq.
The bottom of the document. Do they tell us where it's super safe?
Yes, yeah, so if you're talking about Nordic nations, you'll find the kind of the smaller Nordic nations do very well.
In the smallest of the world. Do we count Iceland as Nordic?
Not yes, really. You do. I think, no, you do count it as Nordic. You don't count
but
it as Scandinavian.
Okay,
yes, correct.
Right.
Because other guys don't say Scandinavian because then the Finns and the Icelanders go ballistic.
Well, I'm glad you said it rather
yeah,
than me
exactly.
Then. Iceland reclaimed top spot.
Right.
Because it's, you know, I mean, who would...
This is before the second ash threat, though.
Well, yeah, exactly. Now that everyone has issues with Iceland again and, you know, you have irate plane passengers
so
in
give,
Edinburgh.
So what are the top five safest?
Why don't you guess?
Okay. Well, Iceland's number one.
Well done.
Thank you.
he's good, isn't he?
I would say that Denmark is in the mix.
It is, yes. Number four.
Sweden. Number four. Sweden.
Sweden, no. Sweden is...
Turmoil Central.
Hang on, where is Sweden?
Perhaps they forgot to go.
No. Sweden is 13th. Sweden is not as safe, or not as peaceful, sorry, as Qatar, which is just above it in 12th.
Right. I'm sure they feel thrilled about that.
Yeah.
I would say Finland is in there.
Again,
top five?
Not top five. Number
well, actually, I've got to say, you could easily get punched in the face of a rowdy
when
Saturday
you say
night.
You're sort of pointing at me.
You.
No.
New Zealand. What about Canada?
Canada is top eight.
Top
as
eight.
In eighth.
New Zealand, yes.
New Zealand is second. Japan, third.
Oh.
Denmark, fourth. And number five, anyone?
Norway.
Any takers?
Norway.
No.
Norway.
Further east and further south.
Further east. Estonia.
Further south than Estonia.
Well, you said east and south, so that would sort of
south.
Take me to Estonia. But
Czech Republic.
Really?
Yeah.
That is surprising.
It is.
Okay.
There we are.
Well, maybe we should head over to San Jose to find out a bit more.
Yes, and in fact, we do have Clyde McConaghy from the Institute for Economics and Peace on the phone right now. Clyde, first of all, I wonder if you could just tell us who the kind of biggest climbers and the biggest fallers have been this year in the index.
We tend to look at the top five risers and the top five fallers because they're the ones that perhaps form, in some ways, an example for other countries to note as to how they can improve or indeed, in some cases, worsen their peacefulness. And this year, the top five risers, Georgia, Sri Lanka and Thailand, all of you, which you'll recognise, have had a difficult time in the last couple of years, and also Chad and Mongolia. But certainly Georgia, Mongolia and Sri Lanka, Sri Lanka and Thailand, are ones that had substantial internal difficulties a couple of years ago and have recovered very well. On the fallers, perhaps unsurprisingly, there's Libya, Bahrain and Egypt are three of the most notable fallers over the last 12 months, and indeed North Korea and also the island of Madagascar has fallen this year as well.
Just looking at the list, I see that a lot of the discussion you base around the list is what would have happened if countries which are actually very troubled now had been peaceful, how their economies would have thrived and grown. Is that the main use of this index? Is it mainly for people who are interested in kind of investment in money and how they can make cash in these countries?
Not necessarily, although that is one of actually the prime messages that we're trying to suggest to people, that there is in fact an economic cost of violence, and that economic cost is not measured in millions or even billions, but in hundreds of billions, and in fact at a global scale, trillions. So the reason that we perhaps take an economic perspective to it is because, as far as we're aware, nobody's ever done it before. Peace has been, to the extent it has been measured, which was very little before we did the Global Peace Index, what we wanted to identify was that, in fact, it's not just a social cost and not just a political cost, but there's also an economic cost. And that economic cost would amount to around $2 trillion per annum in the global economy, of which a proportion of that is what we call a dynamic peace dividend. As in economic terms, if money is reinvested, it circulates around and multiplies. So you might say that even with a quarter of that would make a substantial difference to the global economy.
Clyde, hi, it's Steve here in the studio. I just want to pick up on this point that the countries that perhaps have fallen are now perhaps worse places economically too, because, I mean, surely there's an argument that Tunisia and Egypt are actually now going to be better places economically because they're not ruled by dictatorships. There will be some sort of free market in the sense that there wasn't before.
Yes, that's a very good point, and that's where the GPI has its constraints as well. It is a measure of violence, not necessarily of what necessarily, shall we say, the political or social reasons for that violence, and indeed, as you say, It might be that countries such as Thailand, such as Georgia, such as Sri Lanka that have gone through incredible difficulties in the last 12 months and have recovered on the Global Peace Index, they are also likely to recover economically because they've got a more stable situation than they did. So the economics and the peace elements don't necessarily work in tandem at the same time, but certainly in the short to medium term, there is an economic benefit.
And do you find that with this index that this gives us a snapshot of what's going on right now? I mean, do you get the sense that it can also give us an indication of where we should be looking at in the future? What are the places that we should be more concerned about in the coming 12 months?
Well, I think there's a couple of aspects to that. The first is that it comes back to its uses. Is it only a measure or related to economic benefit? And the answer to that is no. We indeed have it used by governments, politicians, NGOs indeed, business and academia to look at different structures that can create a more peaceful world. And then taking that to a forecasting point of view, what we have not really designed it for at this stage is to be a forecasting tool. Could one have expected, shall we say, that things might have deteriorated rapidly? But that's partly as a result of the fact that the index is only 5 years old, and to be a forecasting tool, it's better to have, well, at least 5 years, and then preferably 10 years or more. So that may well come in time, but I suppose the other aspect I would say, the second point, is that what we have done in terms of analysis of the Global Peace Index itself, along with 33 other, let's call them socio-economic and socio-demographic indicators, is create 8 structures of peace. And those structures of peace, I suppose, areas that governments and other organisations can bring in policy, which would therefore create a more peaceful environment in the future. So if I can just give you an example of, say, 3 or 4 of those, well-functioning government. Now, that may or may not be indeed a democracy, but for the purposes of this, it's a well-functioning government, sound business environment and a free flow of information, high levels of education, particularly high school education, and low levels of corruption. So those are 5 of the structures of peace which, getting back to your point on forecasting, if a government were to focus on those areas in policy terms, then indeed it is more likely that a country will be more peaceful in future. And is it possible that we might be able to, shall we say, predict or forecast that in the future? It's quite possible.
Clive McConaughey, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here in London. We're back in a moment.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Last week, we reported that all's not over in the world of good old-fashioned book retailing, with the announcement that one of Russia's richest men appointed one of Britain's best-loved booksellers to take over the ailing Waterstones chain. James Daunt had this to say about the challenges of the industry.
Who would you bet on, really? Would you bet on the guys who can interact with their customers, build their loyalty, give them a browsing environment, and then integrate that with a dynamic internet offering? Or would you bet on the guys who sell on price?
That was James Daunt. And just to prove that a more mass market model can also work, earlier this week, Sweden's Pocket Shop bookstore chain announced a tie-up with Germany's Thalia to bring its model to Deutschland's book-loving, travelling masses. Per Schadell is the founder of Pocket Shop. He joins us on the line now from Stockholm. Hello, Per.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. Congratulations on your deal.
Yeah, great. Thank you. It's really exciting. We've been working on it for a year now, so it was really exciting to finally get everything in place.
Let's just rewind for a moment. For people who have not gone through Stockholm Central Station or they don't frequent Arlanda, tell us a little bit about your model, and particularly at a time when, if we look at Sweden, you know, very much a nation of early adopters when it comes to new technology. You know, one would probably venture to say that, you know, Sweden's a market where, you know, everyone is reading something off of a backlit screen. And yet here you are with your very small format of selling good old ink on paper. Why has it been working?
I think actually we have a quite focused business model that is based on a few cornerstones. One of them is that we are, as you mentioned, extremely focused on travel retail. So we are in central stations and in airports, and we do paperbacks only. We don't do candy or magazines or a mix of products. And being in travel retail, you have the customer in there, so you don't have the competition from e-commerce, etc. So I think the retail strategy has been one cornerstone. The other one is, of course, when you sell a generic product, as paperback books obviously are, then it's about the way you sell them. And our way of selling them is trying to be experts in doing a great selection for the customers. We actually have about 2,000 or 2,500 titles in quite small stores. You actually have a great selection. You don't just find the top 50 books or something. So you do have a good selection. We have a quite fun store concept. We believe ourselves it's purple. It's very upfront. It's a very kind of Swedish cocky tone of voice and the way we communicate with the customers. And we do focus a lot on training the staff so they can really help the consumer finding the right book. Because actually, it's not just about the price. It's about the time you spend reading. And if you start reading the wrong book, well, then it's a couple of hours or your life wasted. So I think based on these cornerstones, we have tried to build Pocket Shop over the years. And it's been very successful because we have focused on it and we have known who we are. We are guys who love books and we are focused on paperback books and bringing it to the consumer with this concept and the way we do it. Then, of course, as you mentioned, being in Sweden, you live in an early adopter world. So, of course, we are part of the debate. We definitely are highly involved in looking at different e-readers and talking to different partners in the business in these issues. But so far, actually, we believe that by focusing on what we do has been the most profitable way for us so far.
It's Andrew in the studio with Tyler. I want to ask a quick question, which is, the other interesting thing about travel retail for books is that there seem to be very few sectors that you need to stock. So, for example, most it's economics, a good few murders, and there's plenty of Swedish murder books around at the moment, and maybe a few self-help books. Is this the strategy you've followed as well, following just real dense pockets of information?
Actually, what we try to do when we look at the selection of books, I would say approximately 80% of our turnover comes from 100 titles, of course, being top-selling both chick lits and crime novels, etc. But we do carry about, as I mentioned, more than 2,000 titles. We actually try to have a very, very wide selection and work very much with the tail. And by having this tail, that is something that differentiates us quite a lot from our competitors. You can actually walk into quite small travel retail pocket shop unit and find a better selection of books than you would do in quite a lot of, I would say, downtown bigger bookstores. So we are actually very keen on offering a wide selection of books and not falling into just doing what everyone else is doing, what sells best right now. Of course, we offer that. Of course, we make a lot of money on those books. But what differentiates us from others is definitely the tail. And we work very much with the tail. But it's also interesting being in this technical development age that we all are. I think if you compare it to music, for instance, it's quite easy to, you want to have it digital because it takes up so much space with the old way of consuming music. But books, whether it's paperback books or hardcover books, people still have such a personal relationship to it. So I think ebooks will definitely grow and should grow, but there will always also be a need for the traditional book. And actually, I would say, argue at least that the paperback book is still a very practical format. In many, many ways, it's still superior to many of the digital books you can use. I think there is definitely room for everyone, and more people read, the better, whether it's on backlist e-readers or physical paperback books on the beach. So hopefully there'll be room for all of us.
Per, just one last question before we go, and it might be a bit of a rude question, but I'm wondering, was Germany the obvious step? Because it seems that, of course, while we would love better book retail in this country as well, you had to go to a country that had a transport infrastructure that worked.
I think actually Germany, I mean, coming from Sweden, I have a background also in fashion retail, and Germany is always the first market for Scandinavian companies. It's such a big market. It's a lot of buying power. They have a very good infrastructure. It's a very healthy retail environment, where unfortunately the UK is a very, very competitive retail environment. It's harder to be successful in the UK, I would argue. So Germany is a very natural first step for Swedish companies in general, regardless of which product you sell. Focusing on books, then Germany also have a very strong culture of producing very, very good material, and they have very, very good actors in this sector. So it was a quite natural choice for us, and they also have very interesting travel points. The airports are really big hubs for traveling out in the world. So it's huge airports, it's big train stations. So it was, I think, a mix of the airport and train station situation in Germany, as well as them being a very interesting book country from a historical point of view. Then it's also worth mentioning, I'm not sure what the situation is in the UK actually, but it's fixed pricing in Germany for books. In Sweden, it's a very, very competitive price market. So of course, that appeals to us as well, that our concept is even stronger in an environment where you don't compete with price at all.
Great. Per Stadell, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here in London. We're back after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Now, when we were broadcasting from Madrid earlier this spring, you might recall we chatted to Pablo Alomar Salvioni about exporting Spanish wine to Japan. But as it's Sunday, we thought we'd venture out into our own backyard to see how the grapes are coming along in England. With parts of Kent starting to look like stretches of Burgundy, suddenly everyone wants a vineyard. So does English wine stand much of a chance? Well, here to answer that question is Julia Trustam-Eve from English Wine Producers to tell us more about the growing demand for English vintages. Hello, Julia.
Hello there. Good afternoon to you.
How are you?
Very well indeed. And what a lovely day we've got, certainly up here where my office is anyway, enjoying English Wine Week in the sunshine.
Absolutely. Sunny days aside, where do we rank? Do we rank, if you even looked at a top 20-25 league table right now, where does the United Kingdom sit in terms of being a wine producer?
Well, if you're talking quality, we rank pretty highly. And this has been illustrated year upon year, actually, over the last sort of 10-15 years, as how well our wines have done in international competitions. And that, of course, is the best way of illustrating the kind of quality that we're producing. You know, for example, it was a couple of weeks ago now, they announced the results in some of the international competitions that are staged here in the UK. And we came out with some gold medals. And in fact, last year in the Decanter World Wine Awards, which is a pretty globally recognised competition, an English sparkling wine took the International Sparkling Wine Trophy, the first time a non-champagne producer has actually taken that award.
Is that where a lot of the focus is? Because the UK, it normally flip-flops between, I guess, Japan and the UK as the world's largest champagne consumer. So is that where a lot of the effort is as well? And we've heard, we've seen what Nee Timber have done and Gusborne. I guess that, you know, there are many others. Would you say sparkling is where we excel?
Sparkling is definitely the growth sector in English wines, and we produce now over half of our production is going into sparkling wines. And not just that, the greatest majority of that is actually using the champagne varieties, so that's growing Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier. It's something that we found that we grow really well over here, particularly in the southeast of England. You were likening it to Burgundy, and you know, there you go, you've got Chardonnay and Pinot Noir there. We are obviously, domestically, we're also significant drinkers of sparkling wines, not just from champagne, but from all over the world. I think we're one of the biggest markets, as you say, for champagne. So we are going into, when I say direct competition, I'm talking in terms of quality. It's definitely the standard to which we are aspiring as producers. And it's definitely a market that we're selling very successfully into.
Is it too early to talk about large-scale investment on the parts of some of the major global players that we would see at LVMH, you know, doing what they did in Chile, what they've certainly done in Australia, or snatching up something like Cloudy Bay, for example? Are we, you know, 3 years away, or are we, you know, mere months away from some of the big players saying, look, we want, you know, a sizable stretch of Sussex because we think there's something to do there?
Well, I think it's certainly something that we could be preparing ourselves for in the future. I mean, at the moment, the investment has been from private individuals, either people who are currently landowners or have actually sought land and invested heavily into planting vineyards over here. It has been the case, and it's been reported that a few years back, we have had some site visits from some of the champagne houses. So we will wait and see. At the moment, you know, it's very much as a domestic industry, if you like. Having said that, you know, one or two of our owners are from international backgrounds as well. The one thing that I would say, of course, is that it's kind of getting it into context in terms of where we fare with some of the other sparkling wine producing regions. We're a very small producer. Just really the landmass that we've got dedicated to vineyards at the moment is tiny compared to some of our better known regions. Last year, for example, we produced what will be equivalent of about 4 million bottles, which for us we're very proud. It's the highest we've ever produced. But when you compare that to something like 340 million bottles that Champagne alone produces, it just kind of puts it into context slightly.
Julia, it's Andrew here in the studio with Tyler. I wanted to ask two little connected questions. The first one is about the kind of the image of English wines.
Yep.
Do you think there's still a kind of lag between you're making these wines at great quality, but actually there's still a kind of prejudice, actually oddly amongst English people, against English wines in certain quarters, that people are kind of reluctant to kind of take a bottle of an English sparkling wine around to dinner if they can take a bottle of champagne? And two, the second thing, it always strikes us as, you know, that some of the best wines from this country are actually very expensive.
To answer your first question, I've been working with the English wine industry now for nearly 20 years, and I've seen such a change in attitude to English wines. We've had, I think, very much led by the success in competitions of our wine producers and our wines, and that is something that's been very widely reported. It's been great to see very positive press of our wines over the last few years, and that sort of that certainly encouraged the wine consumer to sort of think more positively about it. Added to which, there's greater availability of English wines too, and it's a talking point. You know, in the UK, we obviously like to talk about something sort of different and unusual in the world of wine. And for example, at the beginning of this year, we've had a royal wedding, of course, and the level of sales has grown extraordinarily high. In the first period, the first quarter of this year, the sales were 50%, in some cases almost 100%, compared to the same period last year. Now, that definitely reflects that people are buying into it. I do concede, however, that we've got some more awareness building to do, and as more wines become available and come on stream, as they will be, so will consumers be buying into it.
And on the cost issue, sorry, on just the very high prices you pay for the best English wines?
It's an interesting one. I guess it's all down to perception. And of course, in the UK market, you know, there's a very large market for wines selling under £4.50, that sort of thing. That's not the market that we're aiming our wines for. Our wines, again, I come back to the competitions because it's a very fair illustration of where we are. You know, some of our, let's say sparkling wines, they're going into competitions and beating sparkling wines that actually are retailing at £10, £20 more than our ones. So I think a lot of it's perception. You know, you're looking at premium quality wines, single estate in many cases, and of course that's the kind, you know, you'd expect to pay a slightly high premium on a bottle price.
Julia, hi, this is Steve in the studio here. I just want to pick up on this issue of perceptions of how people see English wines. Do you get a sense that actually when it's marketed as being from a certain region, it's, you know, this is wine from Kent or wine from Sussex, that you see that there are certain regions that people are a bit happier to associate themselves with or see as being slightly superior?
I think in the consumers in the southern half of England, I think certainly there is a growing knowledge of and buying into, you know, as you say, a wine from Kent because they know that wine is grown in Kent. What we found with trade customers and consumer customers, the further north you go, where you know, you've got fewer and fewer, if any, vineyards in certain counties, they're buying into the fact that it's English wine, and English for them is a region, if you see what I mean. We are aware that certain retailers that are positioned in certain counties like to show that they're selling a county's wine. So it's kind of twofold, actually. What we've been doing, I think, has been running concurrently, really, with the growing awareness in local and regional food as well. So I think English wines can sort of stand alongside that too.
Julia Trustmeave, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment with this week's monologue. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly in London, where it's time for this week's monologue. Today, our editor Tom Morris looks at the pros and cons of the upcoming musical festival season in the Northern Hemisphere.
I hope you've packed your baby wipes, antihistamines and a cagoule, as any decent music lover's three-month-long happy hour is finally upon us. Festival season has started. Each summer, fields everywhere from Reading to Riverside come alive to the beating drum of an entire, well-sided generation, dancing at one with the music. A flag in one hand, a can of something in the other, a slogan T-shirt and face painted. Surely there's nothing better than a festival. Gigs are great, summer is great, fields are great. Surely a three-day-long gig in a summer field is the ultimate. I wholeheartedly disagree. My relationship with festivals began sceptically a few years ago at Latitude Festival near the Suffolk coast in the UK. I decided family-friendly Latitude would be a painless weekend to whet my festival appetite. From the moment I found myself desperately pitching my tent at 10 p.m. in the tinkling drizzle, hearing the last echoes of Franz Ferdinand play 6 acres away, I realised even this softcore choice of festival was perhaps a tad too gritty for me. As I unfurled my last wet wipe from its sheath for my miserable morning wash 2 days later, I vowed never to return. I certainly didn't regret my decision upon receiving friends' SOS calls from Bestival later that year, emitted from the drowning swamps of the Isle of Wight, where tents swam around in the mud like dishes in a kitchen sink. Nor did I question my festival aversion upon hearing from chums at last year's record-breakingly hot Glastonbury. The Poor Mites joined 200,000 other parched music lovers in a collective maypole dance around tree trunks in a three-day-long pursuit of some shade. This summer, though, I'm willing to give festivals one more go and prepare myself for a change of heart. With more festivals to choose from than ever, surely there's one out there to suit me. I do like summer, and I do like fields, and I do like the sound of glamping, that buzzword for luxury camping, so this year I've decided to give festivals one last chance. At least while I'm still young enough to recognise some of the increasingly obscure bands' names. My enthusiasm was peaked last summer when I attended Port Elliot Festival, held in Cornwall in the shadow of an Isambard Kingdom Brunel viaduct and a grand country house. Albeit as namby-pamby's latitude, I was coaxed into attending by friends' promises of walled gardens, lunches of Prosecco and lobster, and something I'm told is standard practice at most festivals, nights spent dancing in the woods. You can also pitch your tent anywhere you fancy, and you're more likely to bump into your favourite poet than some posho off their box dressed as a pirate. It was charming, and this year, me and my bell tent are booked for the penultimate weekend of July. Martin Scorsese has curated an open-air movie programme, and Edmund Duval and Hanif Qureshi will be appearing. If I could, I'd also A380 over to Fuji Rocks the weekend after. As well-behaved as Port Elliot, where else would you be able to hear the world's best bands? Coldplay and the Arctic Monkeys are headlining this year, whilst eating life-changing udon noodles blissed out in a Japanese forest. Or I boat myself round to Garden Festival in Croatia, a tiny DJ-heavy festival which takes place on the small peninsula on the cobalt waters of the Adriatic. And then I'd pack my tent away until September for the Electric Picnic Festival in Ireland. Or hold out until December, when the legendary Hay Festival hosts its edition in Cartagena, Colombia. What's the secret to all of these choices? Crucially, they're abroad, so the chances of needing that cagoule are mercifully reduced, though I'll still be stockpiling a whole tent's worth of baby wipes. For Monocle, I'm Tom Morris.
That was our Tom Morris. I want to jump back one segment. Andrew, do you have a lot of English sparkling in your fridge?
I don't. You know, I feel a bit bad about it, actually, because you know, whenever I've tasted it, I like it, but I'm not somebody who naturally is inclined to go to the English section of the supermarket shelf to look for English wines. And it's bad because, you know, every time I taste it, I like it, but I'm a bit old-fashioned.
Is it partly you think you'll just be embarrassed if you turn up at a dinner party and it's...
But that's what why I asked that question, because I think it is intriguing that it has won plaudits and it does kind of sit on wine lists in very good positions. But still there is a slight perception, I think, that no matter what she says, when you do take an English bottle of sparkling wine to certain places, people think, oh, it must be cheap. And as I said, the odd thing is it's actually not cheap. It's quite expensive.
And it's a tricky branding exercise as well, because you can't go over the top if you went into, whether it was, Harrods in London or you were in a great wine store in New York and overdo it with Union Jacks and everything else as well, because that's going to seem a little bit try hard at the same time, because then it just looks like it's on special.
Well, I think that's also why, I'd be interested whether they experiment a bit more with, this is wine from Sussex or this is wine from Kent. Looking at specific regions and thinking, okay, well, let's try and market this as, this is the area where we do really great wine. It's not just English wine. This is Kent wine.
Well, I wonder if there will be a big regional branding initiative, and it's with so little decentralized here, do you think a county council is going to be able to say, well, let's hive off this much money to obviously promote our vineyards? And of course I can imagine what the taxpayer would say, well, no, because you're just all going to get trashed the whole time.
But what's funny was the thing that you were saying about that you can imagine that somebody will come in and see the kind of the marketing possibilities, and they will see how to turn one of these. Because what's interesting at the moment is that some of these vineyards are becoming, their names are becoming known. So it's not just that they make wine. So you are beginning to know the names. So there is a possibility to kind of create a few successful little brands, I think.
Yeah. Can I just raise a complaint?
About Birmingham?
No.
We can all raise a complaint about Birmingham.
Anyway, right, moving on.
Yes, go on.
When The Weekly did a thing about Spanish wines in Madrid, there was wine. I mean, I only know this because I listened. I wasn't actually there. But we've done a whole thing about English wine and we had no English wine here today.
It's too early for mimosas. Fair enough. Or otherwise. Well, it's true. I mean, but you know, I have to say that there's certainly not budget cutbacks in this program. I must also say that that guest, Mr. Savioni, was also in studio as well.
Okay, fair right. enough.
And maybe the Wine Producers Association, they could have, you know, biked down a box to us, but they didn't.
Yeah, well, maybe we should have not had them on unless they'd brought some wine.
This is true, but it is interesting also that the focus on the top end of the market and the sparkling side, and we didn't get into the complexities or not of making it, but it's also interesting to really go for high margin up front where you know, with the right type of foil on top, etc. Yes, you can also, you know, are you driving them through 300%, 400%, 500% markup as well?
I think there's a very good move on their part as well, because traditionally when English wines came out 20-odd years ago, or those very first ones that were hitting supermarket shelves, they weren't at that level. They were cheap. And again, I think that's a part of the image problem. People have got used to those very cheap ones and not great wines all that time ago. And now that there are these quality ones, I think it's a strategy to go for, because, you know, they're not ever going to produce the kind of numbers that a Champagne region will produce.
I tried a very nice one, I believe from Kent, called Gusbourne. Very, very good. Quite apple-y.
Well, it's
not a breakfast drink, Andrew. Okay. Too excited. Well, it could be.
I often have a bottle of cider for breakfast.
That's true.
You do indeed.
I've seen him. And we're not talking weekends.
No, anyway, I think maybe it will be a move for us with our summertime entertaining, that maybe we should have a couple of cases. Do you think?
Okay. I thought you were going to say we're going to go wine crushing or something.
We could do that. That's for summer team building.
Okay.
That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly, edition 102. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills. Our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company in London. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember to catch up with us daily via our Monocolum on our site. Next week, I'm not going to be here. Did you know that?
Really?
I'm on holiday.
Mm.
Yeah,
I'm
going to be on holiday. So I think it's going to be, it's probably going to be Rob if he's feeling all right.
Oh,
probably going to be you, Andrew, and might just be you, Mr. Bloomfield. So have fun.
Fair enough.
But we'll be like the nurses. Holidays.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But for now, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Steve Bloomfield.
See you soon.